Your son?
Yeah. To tell you that I was the one that emailed you about the homework submission.
Oh, you put it under the door? Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
Awesome. Okay. Okay, I'm going to get started. And we've been through the theory of critical sections. So we talked about critical sections. There were three criteria: mutual exclusion, bounded weighting, and progress, or the other way around. We talked about software solutions. And decided that those are not very practical. We need real-life solutions. So real-life solutions and we'll stick to disabling interrupts and test and set. Disabling interrupts is very commonly used in systems that have only one processor because it works great. And test and set is exclusively used for systems that have more than one processor because disabling interrupts does not work in that case. Someday I'll talk about why don't we just use test and set everywhere. No, in single processors you use disable. Don't use test and set. So yes, there is some hardware non-portability issues here. That is, an operating system is designed for single processors or multiprocessors. What about off-the-shelf operating systems today? They have a flag in there which goes between multiprocessor and single processor code. Okay, so test and set is one of actually a family of instructions, compare and swap, exchange, there's some others, but we'll stick to test and set because that's the most common academic instruction. So what I did in the last class was that is initially like initial values of flags and turns, same thing. There's just one variable, which is test and set, which is x. And this x, we use the test and set operation on x before entering the critical section. So this looks very simple. What does test and set actually do? Does anybody remember? What is test and set? Yeah.
It's an atomic operation that returns the previous value of
the argument.
Yeah.
So it and sets it to 1. Thank you. This one's and it's atomic. Okay. What does atomic mean in this context? What's so magical about this and coupled with the fact that it's atomic? If it wasn't atomic, what would have happened versus what does this atomicity guarantee? It's an important thing. We did say several times that this is atomic. Yeah.
It
Wait. More than one opcode? We're talking about one opcode, test and set.
If you have one opcode, then you can switch.
Say that again. Yeah, think it through.
C has just one value, but it has to execute.
Which has one value?
It enforces the critical section.
No. The atomic doesn't mean it enforces critical section. I'm building a critical section. The operation is guaranteed to?
Complete without interruption.
It's partially correct. What if it's simultaneous execution? That is, nothing is getting interrupted. There are two test and sets happening on two processors of the same system. At the same time, in parallel. On the same variable, yes, on the same variable. Not interruptible will make sense in a uniprocessor, and it's true. Not interruptible, this whole thing has to happen, no interrupts. No context switches, no nothing. In addition to that, but that doesn't work when you have two CPUs, which almost everybody has these days. What happens if two test and sets are executed at the same time? So let's. So the value of x is 0. This guy does a test and set x, and we do a test and set x. Of course, it's a while loop, so I can say it returns y1, and this returns y2. Those are private variables. And somehow, the worst case is these two happen at exactly the same time. Now the hardware designer of the system has to give me a guarantee. And what guarantee does he or she give me? Me being the person who writes software. I think you said it right, but I didn't hear you. Now, maybe we haven't introduced the concept of a lock. So, I better stop. But you can rephrase it, maybe. Let him try, or if you... This variable X, you mean? Correct. Okay, I'll rephrase it. You want to say it some other way?
It's guaranteed to be sequential.
Guaranteed to be sequential, but they happen at the same time.
But one opcode can execute.
Parallel processors execute as many. We're talking single cycle CPUs. So in each CPU, only one instruction opcode executes at one point in time. But if you have multiple CPUs, then multiple opcodes execute in different CPUs, right? So then, let's say we have two CPUs. One executes test and set, the other executes test and set, two completely separate processing units. They can both execute this at the same time. Atomic means pretty much what he said, that one has to wait for the other. That is somehow hardwired in these CPUs is the notion that the final result, I'll make it overtly complicated. The final result has to be the same as some sequential execution. It should look like it wasn't done in parallel, it was done one before the other. Or one test and set made sure the other test and set didn't happen till this test and set completed. So essentially, these two cannot happen together, even though I said, of course, they can happen together. The hardware will allow everything to happen together except test and set. Test and set can happen in parallel with add, subtract, multiply, whatever. But two test and sets together will not happen. Why not? Well, that's the hardware designer's job. Okay? So then, what can we say about the results of this execution? What's the value of x? What's the value of y1? What's the value of y2? This thing got over. X has a value, y1 has a value, y2 has a value. Can you make any claims about the values? They're all one?
Except y1.
Except y1 or except y2. Okay? X will be 1 because two processes set it to 1. Y1 and y2 we don't know. In y1 and y2, both can't be 0. If it was not atomic, at least 1, 0, at most 1, 0. Wait, did I say that right? At most 1, 0. 2 zeros are not good. 2 ones are also not good. But there can be more than 1 1. Okay. At most 1, 0. The reason why I'm saying at most 1, 0 is a non-atomic execution can lead to 2 zeros. That's the guarantee in atomic. If it was non-atomic, if test and set was not atomic, you could get 2 zeros. Test and set is atomic, you only get 1 0. What's the mystery behind that? That's a strong statement. It follows from the definition. I didn't invent anything. Why must there be 1 and no more than 1, 0 between y1 and y2?
Because after the first t set, it'll set it to 1.
After the first t set, it'll set it to 1. But the first t set will return a 0. And after that, it'll return a 1. And they don't happen together. And if it happened together, then both of them would return 0, the old value, and both of them would set it to 1, which is what will happen if you just coded it like the way I did. Take the old value, set it to 1, return the old value. That's not atomic. Code is never atomic, other than this magic instruction called test and set. So that's the only guaranteed. No. The three instructions that are atomic: load, store, and test and set. Okay? So, if I'm using this method of getting critical sections, why am I using a while? It says whoever got a 0, 1. If I didn't get a 0, try it again. Right? And then eventually, whoever got the 0 will set x back to 0, and I'll get a 0 return. And I will set it to 1 atomically. So that's why this code works. How many simultaneous threads or processes can use this? You know, we had a two-process solution. We had an n-process solution. What kind of a solution is this? Think about it. Obviously, 2 works. Does 3 work? 4 work? Do we call it an n process solution? Actually, no, because n means it's a fixed number. You've got to use n. Set it. No, this is a variable number of threads can use this. So So it's kind of better. Why? Because if multiple threads use it and they approximately hit test and set at the same time, then one of them will get the zero, will win, the others will just jump around. And if they don't hit it at the same time, whoever solitarily hits it will get the zero, do its stuff, set it back to zero. Okay. Now comes the... It is very important to remember that critical sections are bound by these three rules: mutual exclusion, progress, and bounded weighting. So I'm claiming this test and set kind of sort of works. Does it really work? Does it get mutual exclusion? She's agreed, you're agreed, everybody. You really have to know why test and set gives you mutual exclusion. By itself, it doesn't. It just sets something to one and returns the previous value. The statement while test and set semicolon gives you mutual exclusion. Does it give you progress? It's like, what is progress? There's a long statement on what is progress. Look it up in the book. It starts with only those processes which want to enter fight amongst each other. Folks that are not interested is not involved in this battle. Okay? Is that true for test and set? You see, test and set happens in amongst those who are doing it at that point in time. So progress is met. Bounded weighting. What does bounded weighting say? Here's a critical section. Here's a critical section. Somebody comes in, goes out. Bounded weighting says that if there are two threads or more, and one of them has gotten in, the other one obviously cannot get in. But before the other one can get in, can this guy come out and go back in? And if it can, then it can keep repeating that kind of bad behavior and lock this guy out. What does test and set do about this? Only one of them has a zero. That gives you mutual exclusion. How would you say test and set provides bounded weighting? It doesn't. Okay? Well, how do you show that it doesn't? Here's my template. I'm claiming it doesn't. No, justify it. What do you mean it doesn't? You want to try?
There's just nothing stopping the first process from returning
one. There's nothing stopping, but there is this process stuck in this while loop. When that comes out, won't this go in? I'm trying to trip her up. In what case will it not go in?
If
Because now x is 0, it does a test and set, it'll get a 0, yes.
Couldn't the scheduler?
There's the bad guy called the scheduler. So if that one is given more priority or a time slice, before this can do a test and set, he does a test and set. So he gets it. How many times will... And after that, the scheduler says, okay, you can try. So it just goes spinning, and then when it goes, okay, you've done enough spinning, let's give it to this one. It comes out, goes back in. How many times can it do that? I'm looking for the word forever.
Is that an N or an X?
Everything's X.
Wait, is that N equal to 0 or X?
It's all X. There's only one variable here, X. Okay, so, yeah, forever. And that's a serious violation of bounded weighting. So saying test and set is a method of getting critical sections is somewhat wrong. But that's what engineering solutions are. We can point you back to Lamport's solution, which does it. Let's go use that. No, we don't want to. So we're stuck with using test and set. You see, the word bounded, I said, how many times can one get in before this guy? If it was, you can do it only 5 times, then it would be bounded. Then bounded weighting would be satisfied. But there is no 5 times. If you can do it once, you can do it forever. So that's why bounded weighting is not satisfied. So should we stop using test and set? Well, we say, let's ignore the fact in real life that test and set is a little stunted and does not do bounded weighting. The reason being, designers of systems or operating systems that use test and set for critical sections make sure that these critical sections are tiny, just a few instructions, and not use critical sections in a lot of places, making sure that the use of critical sections is limited to a few critical places. And as a result, we can make the statement that 90% of the time, or more, much more than 90% of the time, the critical section is not being used. So anybody who wants to get in gets in one without even spinning. Just, whoop, you get in. If somebody else hits on that at the same time, then that person will spin and you'll immediately come out and it'll be a while before you go back in. So the chances of starvation is small. It's not zero. It's small. And we live with that because we don't have a better. Okay, the last statement I cannot justify right now, you'll see it later. Chances of starvation is very small. If this overtaking happens, you're waiting, I jump in, I get out and come back in before you can, it's going to be rare. If it happens, it'll happen a few times and it'll resolve itself because I'll go away. Okay? It's not like a very busy counter where people are jumping the queue. If the counter is not busy at all, nobody will jump the queue because there is nobody else. If you want service, you just go up. Okay? But to keep this true, these two things true, see, critical sections have to be very small. What if I want large critical sections? Is there cases where I want large critical sections? And the answer is yes. Especially in application software, you might want to keep it locked for some time. In that case, there is a technique of building large critical sections out of one small critical section where that critical, it's layering critical sections, it's hard to explain at this moment, but you only have small critical sections which are prone to starvation. The large critical section will not be prone to starvation because that uses blocking and queuing and all that fun stuff, which we haven't done yet.
Right.
Yeah.
What's that one word after it?
Overtaking.
Overtaking.
Oh, overtaking. Overtaking. Yeah, my scribbles. Okay, I'll rewrite it.
Overtaking?
Yes, I did write overtaking. What does that mean?
When the process takes
over another
one.
Yes, process jumps the queue. And there is no queue, so, you know.
What does it mean if it resolves itself?
It resolves itself, meaning if I am constantly taking away stuff from you, I can theoretically do it forever, but it won't happen that way. I'll be busy doing something else, you'll grab the thing. So it resolves itself. And the last part you'll see a little bit later, maybe not today. So I have four processes. T1 and T2 increment A simultaneously. T3 and T4 increment B simultaneously. Whenever such a thing happens, it's a conflict. Race conditions can happen, right? That was the whole thing. So we need critical sections to do it. So we need a critical section to increment A. We need a critical section to increment A. A critical section to increment B because it conflicts with this one. So we need a critical. Now, if I put all these four inside the critical sections, then I have something which is not very good. Why? What is this thing? The increment of A cannot happen simultaneously with increment of A. That's a good thing. Increment of B cannot happen simultaneously with increment of B. That's a good thing. Increment of B cannot happen with simultaneously as increment of A. Who wants that? Why? There's no reason to do that. There's no reason to say T3 and T2 cannot increment variables simultaneously because they're not the same variable. So we want critical sections to be of multiple types. There's an A type and a B type. That is, they don't conflict. All the A types conflict, all the B types conflict, A type and B type doesn't conflict. Can I do this with test and set? Nobody wants to say anything. Okay. There's this variable used in test and set. That variable controls the critical section associated with that variable. Associated with that variable is a technical term. If I'm using X here, this critical section is associated with X. This critical section is associated with Y. The critical section associated with X will not allow simultaneous execution with the critical section associated with X in a different process. So the Ys will keep those two separate, the Xs will keep these two separate. X and Y do not conflict. And I purposely chose X and Y, not A and B. You cannot use A inside the test and set. This is a data variable which has its own semantics. This is a control variable which is only used to control the critical section, not for your computation. Okay? And the computation goes by associating a critical section with X and a critical section with Y, and maybe I can have Z, P, Q, whatever number of critical sections I need, and keep them separate. So multiple critical sections are possible with test and set. So that's about it. This is how you get critical sections. However, somebody long, long time ago, Dijkstra, may have heard his name, said, no, we need a much more general purpose method of controlling processes that does critical sections and a few other things, and it's much nicer, and it's an abstraction, not a particular implementation. Test and set is a particular implementation of a critical section. Disabling interrupts is a particular implementation. Peterson, Lamport, these are particular implementation. Can we have an abstraction through which programmers can express how they want their programs to behave, and this abstraction will get implemented somehow in the operating system? Let's not worry about how it gets implemented. What is a good abstraction for use with concurrent programming? So Dijkstra's method was called, is still around, pretty famous. So the first one that came around was something called semaphores, and I'm going to talk about semaphores. After semaphores, a lot of other abstractions came around, tickets, flags, symbols, all kinds of things, queues. But the one that stuck is called monitors. Now, semaphores is much easier to understand than monitors, so we start with semaphores. Monitors are rather complex. And monitors also has this pretty bad thing that the term monitor is not nothing to do with a monitor. It's nothing like a computer monitor or a monitoring system. Monitors do not monitor. But why do they call them monitors? I don't know. It's just a bad term. So it gives you the wrong impression of what it is. So we'll ignore the monitors for the time being. We'll go with semaphores. So semaphores is a data type. And you can have instances, as you know from... So this thing about a semaphore is it's a data type. It has some internal values and all that which you're not supposed to look at. The only way you play with semaphores are to use certain methods defined on semaphores. Okay? So in Dijkstra's original definition of a semaphore, He said, think about a semaphore as an integer. It's a data type which is the same as integer. But that's not really true. We're going to define it as if it was an integer. This is where it gets a little strange. However, the implementation of the semaphore may choose to make it not an integer. In fact, we look at several implementations of semaphore, it's not an integer. But for the definition purposes of how they work, we're going to think of these things as integers. Okay? The methods are init, p, and v. So in my program, I can use many instances of a type. So if a semaphore is an integer, I can have many integers. But these things, even though we're going to say it's an integer, you're not supposed to manipulate this integer in any way other than to initialize it. You're not even going to ask in your program what's the value of this integer. You never look at the value. You can only do three things. You can initialize it. You can call the P operation or the V operation, not the print operation or what is it or let's increment it. Those are not allowed. The init operation is defined as takes a semaphore and initializes it to zero. I'm sorry, that's not true. Init takes semaphore and a value n, and so why can't you just write S equals Z abstraction? You don't do this. The init routine will do this. The init method will initialize a semaphore because it may not be an integer. It may be whatever you don't know. The implementer chooses how to implement it. We are doing a definition which says, let me tell you how it works, but to tell you, let me assume it's an integer, which I shouldn't, so it has an initial value. And then if you do a P operation on it, I purposely used a go-to, which I'm not supposed to use, to keep the atomic part. So this definition is very universal, very well respected, but it has a lot of problems. But we work with it in spite of its problems. It says the P operation is magic. It takes the semaphore value, and if it's greater than zero, it's going to decrement it. The check and the decrement are atomic. It'll atomically decrement it if it's greater than zero, somewhat reminiscent of the test and set. But this thing can do things that test and set can never do, which we'll come to later. It'll decrement it, but if it's equal to zero, it's going to get stuck in a busy loop. I could write this using a while, but then the atomic part becomes not very clear. So that's why I'm choosing an if and a go-to. Yeah.
Is there a formal definition for atomic?
Yes, something that is indivisible. Happens So if two things are atomic, it's this one before that one, they cannot occupy, in atoms cannot occupy the same space, that kind of thing. And this increment, now atomic again. So that means when this increment happens or this decrement happens, nobody else is incrementing, decrementing, or even looking at the semaphore value. It's indivisibly, instantly happens. Now, one thing I think I have said enough number of times is that code like this is not atomic, it cannot be atomic. You cannot have an atomic increment, you cannot have an atomic decrement, and check and decrement as atomic cannot happen. Yes, Dijkstra knew that. His point was, this is not how it works. This is the effect. This is the definition. How can we get these things to be atomic? Let's not talk about it. We're just going to do it, and then whatever I show now will work as long as this property is met. So, two things. One is, if I want to use semaphores, I've got to build them. If I've got to build them, I've got to find a way of making things atomic. Number two, this has a busy weight which we don't like. It is another defined busy weight to make things wait. And it's a bad idea, but we can figure out a way of not having busy weight. Again, that's the implementation. Thirdly, this, if you look at, has the same bounded weighting problem that your test and set has. It has a similarity to test and set. But that bounded weighting problem, we have to fix in an implementation. And continuing on that, so why is this different from test and set? This is different from test and set because test and set takes a variable with only two values, 0 and 1. This can use a range of values, and that makes a big difference. Okay? So how do we implement these things is for another time. Let's look at what are the possible uses of semaphores. And that's when you see that, oh, this is much more powerful. So this simple thing is a very powerful construct. All the other primitives, including monitors that I talked about, they are all reducible to semaphores. Nothing is better than semaphores, and semaphores are not better than monitors or anything. They're all equal power. It's like, you know, programming languages. Mine's better than yours kind of thing. So it's more on taste and structure rather than the power of the language. Okay? So this looks a little opaque, like, so what? What is so good about it? Why are we doing it this way? And what does P and V stand for? There have been people trying to change P and V to up and down, because semaphores do go up and down, they're signaling things. But somehow P and V has stuck. That was the original definition by Dijkstra, and P and V are the first letters of Dutch words meaning up and down. So it makes no sense to us, but what I would suggest you do, P comes before V alphabetically. In most cases, programs will have P before V. And also, some books and things I've noticed change this to weight and signal. So up to you. You can use weight and signal, but weight and signal is also used in monitors, which causes further confusion, or I prefer P and V. So you can have a cheat sheet saying P is a weight, V is a signal, P is a decrement, V is an increment.
What does P stand for?
Just said, it's a fancy Dutch word for either...
Pause?
No, it's not English. I don't know the Dutch language. So, very standard template of getting critical sections is to have a semaphore, give it a name. Oh, I should have used mutex here. So this is an instance. Mutex is an instance of a semaphore. I could have called it X, I could have called it Y, whatever. And initialize it to 1. Initializing a semaphore to 1 generally means you're using it for critical sections, which looks like is the only thing we need anything for, which is not true. A P mutex followed by a V mutex gives you a critical section. And you don't have to worry about disables, intables, multiprocessors, single processors, test and sets. You can even do larger critical sections if the semaphores are properly implemented. You will get bounded waiting if the semaphores are properly implemented. So there are no restrictions on what kind of critical sections you're implementing. Just use semaphores. Yes?
So mutex is like a specific value of the semaphore?
No, mutex is just a name. So it's an instance of a semaphore. So a semaphore is the reserved keyword. I could have said semaphore S, and put S here. I could have said semaphore P and put, it's just a name. Like, you know, integer is the reserved word, and I, J, K, L, all those are integers. Okay. It's kind of become a little traditional to call the mutual exclusion semaphore mutex. That's all. So how does this work? Semaphore is initialized to 1. Whoever does the P mutex first bumps it down to 0. Whoever does the P mutex next gets stuck, either spinning or using some method that the implementer of the semaphore has used not to complete the P operation. And the V operation will set the semaphore value to 1, and the waiting P operation can grab it. Okay? So I can have processes doing this sort of a thing, any number. So if I could have 3, I could have 4, doesn't matter. Any number of threads or processes, they could be dynamic, they can be built, they can be shut down, all that thing can work. Can use these critical sections. And where's the critical section? I forgot to write critical sections. Where should I write it? Pardon?
In between
P and V. And what will this give me in terms of guarantees? Simply that in these 3 critical sections, so overarching thing is the mutual exclusion property. That is, if I have three critical sections and I have three processes, only one will execute at the same time. Can two processes share the same critical section? Yes, they can, but I'm showing it as separate. Okay? So that's what I started with wanting. That's what we are back. There's nothing very interesting here. Now, can we do multiple types of critical sections? Something we were doing with test and set? Yes. How do we do it? Make multiple semaphores. So you take the semaphore data type. It's not changing. And let's have S1, S2, S3. And then we init all to 1. And I'm not showing the code, just English. Wow, the code I'm... Tell me why what I just wrote makes no sense whatsoever. Can I do this? Yes. Should I do this? Why not? They can all enter the critical section at the same time, so why are we using semaphores? It's the same thing as not using semaphores. But if I add some more with PS1s, now it makes sense. So this is just the framework. You can have multiple semaphores as long as there's more than one thread using the same semaphore. If there's nobody using the same semaphore, it makes no sense. Okay? So this is how you do multiple types of critical sections. These critical sections are not all the same. These two are associated with S1. This one's associated with S2. Hopefully there's more associated with S2. This one is associated with S3. The most powerful thing about semaphores is not critical sections. It's something called synchronization. And it starts with initialize a semaphore to 0. Okay? No, let's not loop back first. We'll put the loops back soon. So I have A followed by... A is just a statement, some statement label. A, PS, B. C, VS, D. This has a strange property. This does some rudimentary form of speed control. If I didn't have these semaphores in there... The execution of A, C, B, D can be in any order. Whoever executes first depends on the scheduler. We have no control over it. Although I know A will execute before B, because that's sequential code. But will A execute before C or after C? Yes. Yes, correct, because we don't know. Even with semaphores A and C, which one executes first, we don't know. If we don't have semaphores B and D, which executes first, we don't know. But with the semaphores, one property happens, which is? Can I say anything about ordering of A, B, and C, D if I have a semaphore? Till now we didn't have the power of saying, I need C to execute before B. Now I do. Why? How does that happen? How can I say C will execute before B? No, because even if they happen simultaneously, if these are two threads, the speeds we know nothing about. Okay? That's up to this bad guy, the scheduler, who will do exactly what you don't want him to do. So, but this one says, I'll tie the scheduler's hands. I'll make the scheduler execute C before B. Yeah. Yes. Right. If this guy is fast, it's going to get stuck here. Because S is zero. And it's going to get stuck here till VS happens, making S one. If VS happens, C has already executed. And then maybe D will happen, we don't know anything about it. But by the time we get to B, C has executed. However, if this guy was fast, it executed C, D went ahead, then this guy came around, it will not get stuck. And it will execute B. But again, B got executed after C. So in any case, B will execute after C. And that's called synchronization. Now if we put it in loops, of course, if A, B, C, D are print statements, you see it. What can you say about the relative speeds of these processes? How many times T1 loops versus how many times T2 loops? Can we say anything? Yeah. Equal? No.
T2 will be faster.
T2 will be, okay. T2 can be faster and could be equal.
T2 can be faster, but T1 will never be faster than T2.
Correct. It'll be equal or T2 will be faster. Why? Because T2 has nothing in it that stops its execution. It can keep on bumping V. Okay? Now it can bump V to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 forever. We don't account for overflow. But then someday T1 can catch up and keep decrementing S. And it'll decrement, and if T1 starts running fast, it'll catch up with T2, but it'll never go beyond S being zero. So it can catch up, it cannot cross over T2. Now this is speed control. T2 is faster. What if I want to make them the same speed? That is, they go 1, 1, 1, 1. Can I do that? Yes, you reverse the thing. So, no, what did I do? Did I do this right? No, I didn't do it right. Okay, there's something wrong here, but let me redo this and then we'll talk about it. That'll make it go step by step. Okay? Because this guy is going to come till here and stop until that guy came here, and then did a P, that'll stop, and this can go back and do an S. So, yeah. Both of them bump it to 1, both of them bump it to 0. Nobody gets ahead of anything. But if I change this code, what do you say about this? Easy to make mistakes with semaphores. How does this behave?
It gets stuck.
It gets stuck. For how long?
Forever.
Also called? Deadlock. Yeah, so this is bad code. It looks like the previous one, but not quite. However, this is where things get a little tricky. So don't do this. Just do S1, S2 equals 1. Does that work? So this one you need to figure out, it does work. How? So you see, we're getting into much more complex, richer strategies with semaphores. We'll soon get into bounded buffer readers and writers, much, much more complicated programs. This one says, they come and both set it to 1, I'm set it to 0, then they both set it to 1, then it continues. What if this guy starts running faster? It's going to get stuck here. It'll set it to 0, and then if that doesn't happen, next time it comes around, it's stuck. This guy can't go faster than that guy can't go faster than this guy. Yes? Oh, that's supposed to be a V, thank you. Oh, should have stopped me before that. Yeah, that's why it made no sense, right? Yeah, I wanted to make it symmetrical. But if you flip the P's and V's, then we'll have to set S1, S2 to 0. If we keep it this way, then we S1, S2 becomes 1. Sometimes you'll see code where it's PS1, VS2, and VS2, PS1. That's also pretty common. Then it's 0, 1 will be 0, 1 will be 1. Okay? So this is synchronized. Synchronization doesn't mean synchronized. Synchronization means some form of happens before relationship, some form of speed control. This one is equal speeds, synchronized. We can also do things like one of them can run faster, but only 10 steps ahead, not more than 10 steps ahead. Yeah, we can do that. So there's a very rich set of control issues that we can implement using semaphores. Okay, so from here, I'm going to divert to something else, but from here, I want to go to much more complex semaphore programs, which does this behavior that incorporates critical sections, synchronization, to create a program that matches certain rules. Okay? And since we've been talking about all this seemingly theoretical things, I thought of showing you how threads work. Okay, this is what I'm going to do on the computer. You already got a project on queues. The next project will be build some threads. Okay, build some threads. The end result of that project is what I'm going to show you. Because after threads, we'll have to try it with semaphores. So I have a program here called demo. That I can play games with. Now in this demo program, ignore the includes, it has a function called function 1, which has a local variable. It has a global variable. Function 1 is an infinite loop. And exactly the same is function 2, another infinite loop with the printf statements changed so that we can identify which one's what. And I've got three functions. Can I run three functions with three infinite loops simultaneously? If you think about it, you can call function 1, you're going to get stuck in function 1. It's an infinite loop. I want to be able to run them at the same time. So what I've done here is use something called yield, which this function will execute, print something, wait, increment variables, wait, yield, which means I don't want to run. Give me a break. Go do something else. Okay? But come back here. Don't abandon me. So I need a scheduler to go do something else. Can this be done? The answer is yes. So here's the rest of the program. That was function 1, this is function 2, this is function 3. The main routine is where it starts up. I init queue, run queue. I start thread, function 1, function 2, function 3. Start thread is not a call. The start thread does some magic, which you'll have to figure out, and call a routine called run, which has an infinite loop, which will never return, which will coordinate the running of these three threads. And if I go ahead and execute this, Maybe I should stop it. Function 1 said global 0, so it incremented, incrementing from function 2, and then it did a yield, went to function 2, global 1, local 0, global 2. One takeaway is that this local is is being incremented much slower than the global. And you can see printouts from all three functions. Function 1 never had a printf saying function 2. So all these three functions are running in some way, and they're all incrementing a global variable. So as many times as it runs, the global variables change. And local variables are separate, global variables are shared. Is this true? Can I comment out function 2 and function 3, what's going to happen? It's not really fake. Now there's no 2 or 3. What if I put back 2? We have function 2 running. Can we do something silly like so we have three functions here. What about I do Is that a good idea? Will it break? How many do I have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 function ones. I hope it doesn't break. What's going to happen is I will get 6 threads. I will get 6, 7, 8 threads. The function one threads will not be distinguishable because they'll be printing the same thing. But if you notice, the global variable function one remainder, that's the 6 function ones. Then you'll have function two remain. So there's 1 function two, 1 function three, there are 6 function ones. And the global's going at a much, much higher rate than the local. Because there's 1 global, all 11 threads, or whatever number of threads are executing it, and the locals are incremented by each thread locally. So this is our goal, to do this. So threads are real stuff. We can write a program to create threads, run them, and then we can try semaphore tricks on it. Okay?
Thank you.
I'll be there.